Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Russian and Eurasian Studies on the New Books Network. My name is Diana Dehanova, and I'll be your host today. Today, I'm speaking with Dr. Alexander Agajanian, professor at the Center for the Study of Religion at Russian State University of Humanities in Moscow, and Dr. Scott Kenworthy, who's associate professor in the Department of Comparative Religion and associate of the Russian, East European, and Eurasian program at Miami University in Oxford, Ohio. We're discussing their 2021 book, Understanding World Christianity, Russia. Dr. Agajanian and Kenworthy, welcome to the program and thank you for joining me today.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Thank you.
So to start off, can you both talk about your research backgrounds and how this book came about?
Alex, why don't you start?
Yeah, I was doing various research on various aspects of religious life in Russia. Mostly since the end of the Soviet Union and the post-Soviet developments of the religious field, more or less everywhere in the post-Soviet space, but mostly in Russia. And Russian Orthodoxy was, of course, at the center of my research since then. And I published a number of articles of different aspects of that, of these developments, and a couple of books. I edited a couple of books on that. So now this kind of general overview of the Russian Orthodoxy as a special tradition was always in the scope of my interest. So I'm happy that we decided to make this kind of collaborative project with Scott, with whom we know each other since many years.
Yeah, from my angle, it was somewhat of a funny story. So the series editor, Understanding World Christianity, Diron Dougherty, wrote to me and said, there's this book, I have this series, and I want to have a volume on Russia. Would you consider doing it? It has more of a contemporary focus to it. And I said, well, actually, I'm more of a historian. The person you should ask if you want the contemporary is Alex Agajanian. And he says, well, actually, I did. And Alex has written about half the book, but he's gotten bogged down with some other projects too. And so I said, well, maybe we can write the book together. And it turned out that Alex had written half, as I said, and the half that remained to be written was exactly the half that would suit me perfectly to write. So that was kind of how the project came about. As far as my own background, I started out with an undergraduate and graduate master's degree in religious studies. And by the end of that time period, with all the kind of revival of Orthodoxy in Russia after the collapse of the Soviet Union, I got interested in Orthodoxy, but there was very little place to study it academically. So I pursued a master's degree in theology at St. Vladimir Seminary, and then went on to complete my PhD in history at Brandeis University, working with Gregory Fries. My first project, my first book was kind of looking at the history of the revival of monasticism in modern Russia, so 19th and into the 20th century, using as a case study the famous Trinity St. Sergius Lavra. And since then, I've been also working on this kind of theological controversy around the glorification of the divine names, the so-called Imya Slavia. And also right now I'm working on a book on, it's a biography of Patriarch Tikhon and looking at the Orthodox Church during the Bolshevik Revolution.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think it's quite clear that your two areas of expertise come together very well for this kind of primer for the history of Orthodoxy.
Yeah.
So you knew each other before, but you hadn't worked together on a project before, is that right?
That's right. But now we're actually co-editing a volume that came out of a conference on sort of religion in the revolution. So hopefully that'll be, the manuscript should be finished actually any time now, and then we're going to submit that.
Great. So this is a very timely book, given that there is an increased interest in Russia in the West during the last decade, and we have this discourse around what the so-called New Cold War. And along with this kind of increased interest in the Western media and in Western academia, there come some misconceptions about Russian culture and history. So what are some of those misconceptions that you address around the history and practices of Russian Orthodox Christianity?
Yeah, I'll start with tackling this question coming from the American perspective. And one of the things that has always struck me in the sense that I come from two academic worlds, as I said, one is sort of the religious studies and study of Christianity and the kind of emerging field of world Christianity on the one hand and Russian studies on the other, is that for people in both fields, there tends to be this gap in knowledge about Russian Orthodoxy. You can read histories of Christianity or introductions to world Christianity, and the treatment of Russia usually is reserved to the briefest repetition of cliches. And despite the fact that it's considered the largest Christian country in Europe, and according to the Pew Research Forum, it ranks fourth in the number of Christians in the whole world, right? So it should be more at the center of attention, but it generally has not been. And also with Russian studies in the West, you know, whether it's literature, political science, or history, very frequently people are trained without very, you know, kind of fundamental grasp in the history and practices and beliefs and so on of Russian Orthodoxy. That's changing, but I think part of the reason this is the case is that there has never been a sort of general work to introduce the student or the graduate student or the non-specialist into this. So we really hope that this book kind of fills that gap. In terms of sort of popular misconceptions, you know, historically, based upon the secular intelligentsia and Western visitors, who had these kind of orientalizing views of Russia, there was this sort of stereotype of the pre-revolutionary Russian priests as all being alcoholics and, you know, uneducated, ignorant people, and of the peasant believers as effectively being kind of pagan with a superficial veneer of Christianity and very superstitious and so on. And these kind of stereotypes have a very long life and get repeated very frequently. And of course are, you know, hardly the case, let's just put it that way, which, you know, more recent research has shown. One of the other sort of outstanding misconceptions is the idea that the Russian Orthodox Church always serves as kind of the handmaiden of the state, as if the church is really just a kind of propaganda arm of the autocratic regime, be that Tsarist or Putin's, you know, historically or contemporary. You know, added to this today, I think especially in Western media, there's this kind of portrayal of the Russian Orthodox Church as this bastion of conservative values, and especially affecting things like women's rights or gay rights and stuff like this. And of course, this is not entirely untrue, especially with what's happening at the contemporary moment, right? And we'll explore some of these things a little later on. But it's important to emphasize that there's a lot of internal diversity within Russian Orthodoxy, and also that these things change over time, right? The relationship between church and state, for example, has evolved over time. And so it's misleading to characterize the positions of, you know, I don't know, the patriarch or some fundamentalist brotherhood as if that therefore tells you about Russian Orthodoxy as a whole, something like this. And just one last point, which is that there's also the possibility to sort of overly romanticize Russian Orthodoxy, whether it's, you know, as a kind of mystical spiritual religion, or especially as gaining saliency in some quarters of American conservatives these days, precisely embracing this idea of Russian Orthodoxy as this bastion of conservatism, but as something that's a positive rather than a negative. Sarah Ricordi Schurz is writing about this, and her book will be forthcoming from Fordham University Press, something interesting to look at.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this is something I found in my own research that, as you said, there is this idea that Russia is, or the Russian Orthodox Church is very conservative, and they have very particular kind of hardline views on a lot of social issues. And I found that, in fact, they take a much more nuanced position on many of these things like marriage, divorce, even abortion than, for example, their Protestant counterparts in the U.S.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And Alex, is there anything you wanted to add?
No, not at this point, yeah.
So one important term that I want to make sure we define for the listeners, right, because there is so little up to now kind of information about Russian Orthodoxy or Eastern Orthodoxy, what do we mean when we say Orthodox or Eastern Christianity? What are some of the defining characteristics that are different from, let's say, the Protestant or Catholic versions of Christianity?
Yeah, this is kind of a huge question that could take up a whole podcast in itself, but I'll try to do it simple, you know, in terms of the basics. We tend to think of Christianity as a quote-unquote Western religion, by which we associate it with Western Europe and North America. And this is one of the things that this emerging field of world Christianity is trying to challenge, because actually today there are more Christians, for example, in the global South than there are in the North or in the West. But at any rate, for the first millennium of Christianity, it was less a European religion than a Mediterranean one, which is really important to keep in mind, and that its early development was perhaps most rich in places like Asia Minor, what's today Turkey, Syria, Egypt, North Africa, and in some ways, you know, France and England were the hinterlands of Christianity for 500 or 600 years. And the spread of Islam, of course, changed that, especially in Syria and North Africa and Egypt and so on, and kind of pushed Christianity further northward. But that happened east as well as west, so into the Slavic world and eventually Russia, as much as into you know, northern Western Europe. The standard date for the split between Western Christianity or Latin or Roman Catholic, the Roman Catholic Church, and on the one hand, and the Eastern Orthodox, Greek Orthodox, sometimes it's referred to, is 1054. I will qualify that term Greek. You know, we can speak of Latin Christianity because Latin was the language of the church, whereas in the Eastern Church, there were always multiple languages. So I think it's more proper to refer to it as Eastern Christianity or Eastern Orthodoxy. At any rate, the split, which happened in 1054, was in fact a long process that began before and continued afterwards. I would argue that the largest issue that divided the churches at that point was the question of church authority. So by that point, the highest church authority in the Western Church was the Pope. It's kind of centered church authority in the person of the Pope of Rome. Whereas in the Eastern Orthodox tradition, you know, the highest church authority, at least when it came to defining issues of doctrine and practice and ecclesiology were church councils, which kind of represented the whole church coming together. So individual patriarchs or heads of churches never had the same kind of authority and were always considered potentially fallible as individuals in the Eastern tradition. And so this kind of contention over church authority became a real dividing point. By that point, there were also other differences in practice. So the Western church was coming to the point where it was insisting that all clergy be celibate, whereas in the Eastern church, it was normal for parish priests to be married. The Western church, as I already suggested, was insisting on Latin as the only language for scripture and worship, whereas the Eastern church always had a plurality of languages from the very beginning. So Coptic in Egypt or Syriac, Armenian and Georgian and so on. And then this tradition continued with the Slavs. So you had Cyril and Methodius in the 9th century who created an alphabet for the Slavs when they began to convert to Christianity and then began translating scripture and liturgy into their language, which was, of course, enormously important in terms of the common people's ability to understand their faith. Theological differences, I would say, became more pronounced after the schism even, and then even more so after the Protestant Reformation in the West. As a very broad brushstroke, just to mention a few things of the differences, one, I think, important point is that Augustine of Hippo, the great North African Latin church father, had a huge impact on the development of Western Christianity. His concepts of the fall and original sin, the relationship of grace and free will, after the Protestant Reformation understood in terms of works versus faith, all of these things were really defined by Augustine, so that even Luther and Calvin were going back to Augustine in debating these issues. And the Eastern Church simply did not read Augustine. Until much, much later, he had no formative influence. And so all of these issues of the relationship of grace and free will are understood much different, and the notion of original sin are understood quite differently in the Eastern Church. And there's more of it's a kind of both-and approach, I would say, in the Eastern Church rather than an either-or one, as you often tend to get in the West. And again, as a very general kind of statement, the Western Church always had this ambition to write these kind of comprehensive theology that was sort of theology as a comprehensive rational system that explained everything, whereas the East always insisted that ultimately God transcends words and concepts and human reason, and that the purpose of theology was really to guide the believer to encounter God. So it was more important, the emphasis was to know God in a kind of direct way rather than understand God with the reason only. And then the final point I'd make is that the Orthodox Church today is organized quite differently than either the Catholic or Protestant churches. It's simultaneously one church in that it shares all the different Orthodox churches share one faith and one liturgy, one creed. One can take communion, right, as a kind of symbol of the church unity, at least, well, what's happening right now is a special case, but in principle, across the Orthodox churches. But it's also a family of churches in that it consists of a series of fully independent national churches. You have the Russian Orthodox Church, the Romanian Orthodox Church, Bulgaria and Serbia and so on, that each have their own patriarch, as well as the ancient patriarchates, such as Constantinople. And these are fully autonomous in terms of their administration. So the Ecumenical Patriarch of Constantinople is considered the highest ranking bishop in the Orthodox world, but he does not have the authority to kind of intervene into the internal affairs of one of the autocephalous national churches. So that's very different than the Roman Catholic model, on the one hand, where the Pope has authority in every Catholic church anywhere in the world, but it's also very different than Protestant churches, where there is this sense of being one church. Maybe the Anglican Communion is somewhat similar, but as a rule, yeah.
Yeah, no, well, a couple of words, if I may, to add to what Scott have been saying. The one thing is that when we are talking about Eastern Christianity, we also distinguish the so-called Chalcedonian churches of, that sometimes commonly called the Greek tradition. Scott was saying that about this distinction as well. So this family of churches, when we are talking about this family of churches, Scott was talking about is, we mean the Chalcedonian churches versus as distinguished from some other Oriental, so-called ancient Oriental churches that are commonly are also included in the what we call the Eastern Christian traditions, Eastern Christianity. So that's another difference within Eastern Christianity. The churches like the Coptic Church or the Syrian Church or the Armenian Church or Ethiopian belong to this so-called ancient Oriental Eastern Christian traditions, as distinguished from Eastern Orthodox of this Chalcedonian or Byzantine tradition, where the Russian Church belongs as well. So this is one thing. And what Scott was saying about this kind of national and political arrangements of all these churches is really very important, because it's connected to the even not so much the political authorities, like let's say after post-Reformation Europe, when there was this distinction between the Catholic and Protestant national, so to speak, national ecclesiastic traditions, but it disappeared in the Western Christianity later with the historical development, while in Eastern Orthodox countries, the orthodoxy, the Orthodox tradition, the religious tradition is very much tied to the national identity. It's sometimes considered as an endemic to this particular territory, the Russian Church with the Russian territory, whatever we mean by the Russian territory, by the way, or the Greek Church in with the Greek. So it's very much close to the national identity, to the ethnic backgrounds and things like that. And that's very, very much distinguishable as well, even in Orthodox diasporas all over the world, like in Europe or United States or elsewhere. One comment to what Scott was saying about the orthodoxy, kind of the textual integrity of the Western churches versus something that we call orthopraxy, which is at the center of the Eastern Orthodox tradition, we cannot over-emphasize or over-simplify or exaggerate this distinction, because, of course, in the Western Church, tradition, we also have this strong mystical tradition with oriented to the direct contact with God. But it's true that the Western tradition is much more logo-centric, more texto-centric, more attached to some kind of clear textual tradition and the sacred words than in the Russian in the Eastern Orthodox tradition. Thank you.
And again, in kind of broad strokes, could you also talk about some distinctive characteristics specifically of the Russian Orthodox tradition in comparison to the other Eastern Orthodox churches?
Well, I'll just make one point. I mean, ultimately, they share more, I think, than they're different. There's obviously differences in terms of language and iconographic styles, you know, church art and things like this. I think among the family of Orthodox churches, the Russians have this kind of reputation for being ultra strict. So this in terms of how they relate, for example, to other Christians, they're less open to kind of dialogue as a rule with other Christians than, let's say, you know, the Greeks or the Romanians. And even this translates today into kind of popular practice. So just anecdotally from personal experience, you know, I think for serious church-going Russians today, you know, there's a certain kind of almost way people dress and their physical appearance, and a sense that, you know, you wouldn't go out drinking with your friends on Saturday night and then go to church on Sunday morning, that somehow those are just ultimately contradictory. Whereas from personal experience in Romania, I know that, you know, it was quite common for my students, I was teaching there in Fulbright, to, you know, go out drinking with their friends on Saturday night and go to church on Sunday morning. There was a sense of church being more integrated into people's lives rather than this strictness of the way things are perceived in Russia. The consequence being, in this case, that, you know, it's like less than 5% of Russians go to church on a regular basis, whereas, I don't know, some 25 or 30% of Romanians go to church on a regular basis. So it has an impact in the popular level. Alex, what more may you say about that?
Well, speaking about this distinctive characteristics of the Russian Orthodox tradition, in addition to some doctrinal or not doctrinal in terms of, well, because Eastern Orthodoxy has the kind of common universal, some universal doctrines that shared by all the churches, of course, but I would say that what is really different is something that is explained by the historical tradition, by the historical destiny of this huge territory that has been expanding all the time. I mean, Russian Empire and the imperial tradition that continues and is still there right now. So the Russian Orthodox tradition, comparing to, say, Greek tradition, Greek or Romanian or some other Orthodox traditions, is at the very same time a national church related to the kind of national identity of Russians, but also an imperial church, huge imperial church that would include minorities or ethnic minorities of many kinds, or the Russians that are scattered around this huge territory and being in contact with other religions, other ethnic groups, other national groups, and so in this sense, the Russian Orthodox Church is unique comparing to other Orthodox churches.
Let's talk a little bit about historical context. So what was the experience of the Russian Orthodox Church and of Russian Orthodox Christians during the Soviet period?
So this is very much crucial for understanding Russia today. And I would say that there tends to be two kind of historical misconceptions. One is that, especially with the early Soviet period, that the Soviets were trying to establish a secular state and have separation of church and state, somewhat maybe similar to the West, and that it was the Orthodox Church that rejected the Bolsheviks and sort of remained close to the monarchy and therefore operated as some kind of counter-revolutionary agent, which thereby justified the Bolshevik crackdown on the church. This sort of narrative had a long persistence among people who studied Soviet history, even in the West. The other kind of common misperception is that, pertaining more to the late Soviet period, is to portray the Orthodox clergy as if they were all KGB agents in cassocks. And I would, you know, these are both issues that really need to be complicated and nuanced. So in terms of the early period, of course, the Bolshevik Revolution was not just about establishing political control. It was really a utopian project of creating a new society, a new man, a new humanity somehow. And therefore, culture was as important to them as politics. So from the beginning, they sought to dismantle the Orthodox Church as an institution, partially to neutralize it because they feared it as a political threat. Although, in fact, the evidence that it was, you know, planning some kind of counter-revolution is extremely thin. But the Bolsheviks also sought to eradicate religious faith among ordinary citizens. And all of this unfolded in various stages that, you know, is discussed in more detail in the book, but very quickly came to repressive measures, especially against the church hierarchy in the revolutionary years and through the 1920s. And then by the 1930s, simply erupted into kind of massive repressive measures, not only against all of the clergy, not just the hierarchy, but even ordinary believers. And this culminated really in the Great Terror of 1937-1938, which few people realize that that religious believers and activists were actually a specific target of the terror. And in the book, I quote this one report from Yezhov, who was the head of the secret police, which he sent to Stalin November 1937, in which he reported that in just 4 months of the terror, they had arrested over 30,000 church people and sectarians, he calls them. So 166 bishops, over 9,000 priests, over 2,000 monks, and almost 20,000 what he calls activist believers, so non-clergy, but just believers, and sectarians. He sort of lumps those as one group. And that of those, half of the clergy had already been executed, the other half being sent to the gulag, of course, and that one-third of the ordinary believers had also been executed. So it's the level of the persecution during the terror, especially, is colossal, right? And the damage against the church was colossal. Then, of course, during World War II, there's this complete reversal of policy in the anti-religious campaign, and propaganda simply ceases as there's this sense that the entire society needs to unite and mobilize against the Nazis. And then what develops in the later Soviet period, especially after Khrushchev renews the anti-religious campaigns in the late 1950s and early 1960s, which found expression primarily in terms of closure of churches and monasteries and seminaries. So they weren't shooting people anymore under Khrushchev or sending nearly so many to the gulag, but there was still this anti-religious campaign, which people don't often realize. We usually think of Khrushchev as the reformer who was engaged in de-Stalinization, but not in the religious sphere. And so what emerges in the late Soviet period is this kind of strict control over the church that the Soviets exercised. So religious life persisted at some kind of very limited level. But this idea that, you know, the clergy were simply KGB and cassocks on the one hand is one stereotype, or the other more nuanced one tends to emphasize the the compromised hierarchy, but the heroic individual dissidents, like somebody like Father Gleb Yakunin or something like this. Either one of those pictures doesn't capture the entire complexity of what happened in the late Soviet period. There was this film, Chuda, The Miracle, about this kind of story, which apparently has some truth to it, but I won't go into that, about a young woman who was blasphemously dancing with an icon and then basically gets frozen and so on. Anyways, the point I want to make is that there was talk about this, the rumors were spreading and so on. And in the film, the local Soviet authority comes to the priest and he says, either you denounce this miracle from the pulpit or I'm going to close the parish church. All right. So very often religious, priests and believers were put into positions where they're forced to make decisions where neither decision was good, right? It wasn't a black and white, like either you are compromising with the Soviets or you're a heroic dissident. No, either of those decisions were bad, right? From the priest's vantage point, you could say. So the story of the late Soviet period and how people managed or attempted to adapt their faith is one that really is only beginning to be told and is much more complex than we realize. I'll stop there. Alex, yeah?
Overall, that was really a period of different, fantastic different strategies. There was the strategy of survival. Well, just finding kind of modus vivendi of different kinds, like from the catacomb underground church to some small niches that existed, that still existed, or downgrading the whole faith, the whole orthodoxy, to some kind of elementary practices in the villages or cities by people who were trying to keep the tradition just on the level of kind of folk tradition that existed, but at the same time the search for a kind of acceptable compromise with the power, with the authorities, whose idea was to eradicate the church. And the final final result was that this eradication didn't work. It was not possible to eradicate, because it's kind of a resilient tradition. Religion is such a resilient thing that existed in different forms and survived in different forms. Although the Russian history under the Soviet Union was a part of the general, I would say, Western modern trend to secularization. So that's also kind of a perspective that we need to keep in mind. So it was the kind of a radical, most outrageous avant-garde, so to speak, Soviet form of secularization that we had in Russia, but what we had after the end of the Soviet Union showed that the eradication or its disappearance was an impossible goal to reach.
Yeah, so let's actually talk about the post-Soviet period. So what was the impact of the collapse of the Soviet Union on the Russian Orthodox Church?
Yeah, there were. I think that we can talk about the two levels. One level is kind of everyday religiosity, and the second level is kind of a political arrangements that came about with the end of the Soviet Union. On the level of everyday personal religiosity of many people, the end of the Soviet Union was a time of really resurgent interest towards religion that actually started in the late Soviet time, as Scott mentioned, the worthy anti-Soviet dissidents with a very, very strong religious component, so to speak. And there were lots of groups of this kind of dissident groups of this kind with some religious ideas that they sprung that actually evolved into this huge movement of revival in the beginning of 1990s, actually as the end of 1980s, when with the perestroika and with the changes towards liberalization under Gorbachev. So this religious revival that we call it lasted for maybe 5 to 10 years. Then it started to go slower. During this 10 years, or maybe a little bit more, there was a huge number of people with sincere faith who joined the church, including the priesthood and or the lay communities as well. So that was really the time of the rediscovery of the tradition. Speaking of the second level, the as I said, the political arrangements and the political consequences of the dissolution of the Soviet Union. Of course, the first thing is the split of the Russian Orthodox tradition into a few national sub traditions, if you want, that with because of this kind of new national borders between the Russian Federation, Ukraine, Belarus, and the Republic of Moldova, there was another Eastern Orthodox tradition on the former Soviet in the former Soviet Union that was Georgia, the Georgian Church that also belongs to this Eastern Orthodox tradition, but it was separate from the earlier time. So after the dissolution of the Soviet Union, all these networks were questioned, were challenged because of the national projects in each of these countries. Well, the Russian Federation continued to be a kind of continued to live with a kind of a memory of the imperial influence and power, but Ukraine and Belarus and Moldova, where the Russian Orthodoxy existed in terms of ecclesiastical administration, started to be challenged by this kind of national separation, and we know that the results the one result in the very beginning of the post-Soviet period in the 1990s was the split within the Moldovan Church. In church in Moldova, part of the church was joined the another ecclesiastical tradition of the Constantinople Patriarchy. The same episode was in Estonia when the Russian Orthodox tradition split into two, and also a part of it joined Constantinople, and then. We have this huge problem and huge change the last few years with the development of Ukrainian autocephalous church that was established in 2018, 3 years ago, actually, and that posed a huge problems and conflicts within Eastern Orthodox communities in general. Maybe Scott wants to to add something.
No.
Okay. So the focus of your book is obviously Russian Orthodoxy, but you also talk a little bit about other denominations. So could you talk just briefly about the relationship between Russian Orthodoxy and other denominations and how non-Orthodox Christianity is generally perceived in Russian society?
I can start. And as I mentioned earlier, there is this kind of duality in the Russian Orthodox tradition in terms of its political history and its history of the involvement with the societies and polities. The Russian Church is both national Russian project, so to say, but at the same time, it's a kind of imperial church that is exposed to many to the impact and negotiation, the negotiations and communications with other denominations. With both Christian and non-Christian religions, by the way, so we don't we should not forget the non-Christian religions like Islam, which is the second largest Islam in Russia religion in Russia in terms of adherence and belonging, and also the Buddhist there have been long relationships with other Christian denominations, the Catholic and the Protestants, at least from the time of Peter the Great in the early 18th century. Now the Russian Orthodox Church is very much involved in the kind of a political processes in Russia. It is considered as a kind of in spite of the existing norm of separation of church and state, the Russian church is, Orthodox Church is, of course, considered de facto dominant and national church. At the same time, there is the group of so-called traditional religions. What I mentioned, Islam and Buddhism and Judaism, the traditional Russian religions of the Russian Empire, that form a kind of a special group that is distinguished from all the rest, but also the traditions of Protestant, the Protestant Catholics, as I said, since a few centuries. Are present here as well, and although there is a kind of a strange relationship with other Christian denominations, because in the laws that are now regulating the religious pluralism and religious freedom in Russia. There is definitely a mention of Russian Orthodoxy as the leading religion, and also the traditional religions are mentioned, those three that I mentioned. Traditional Christianities, other Christianities like the Catholics and Protestants, are not specified, so there is a kind of a ambiguity in terms of relationship with them. There are some official commissions under the executive powers that bring together all the denominations existing in Russia, and definitely Russian Orthodoxy. And personally, the Russian Patriarch play the leading role in arranging these kind of meetings that are not very often, though, and not quite having really no much impact on real politics. So that's kind of complex relationships. That's maybe Scott want to add something.
Okay. So let's kind of talk about what would you like to see be the key takeaways of your readers about from this book?
Well, I think perhaps the biggest thing is that Russian Orthodoxy, Christianity in Russia and Russian Orthodoxy are very complex. And so when we see things like the patriarch making some kind of statements or something like this, we can't make assumptions that this characterizes what constitutes this tradition. For example, you know, one of the kind of stereotypes, especially of the Russian Orthodox Church after Peter the Great's reforms, as if the church was completely subordinated to the state and became a department of state. I mean, you read this every book you pick up. And of course, you know, the Patriarchate was abolished. Peter the Great created the Holy Synod, which was this kind of parallel system for the church, parallel with the state. But, you know, my first book where I wrote a 500-page book about monasticism in Russia, and the state didn't figure hardly at all in the story, except for the very beginning when Catherine the Great confiscated all the monastic estates. But the rest of the story, if you're talking about religion on the ground, the state doesn't really matter very much. So this kind of to make these kind of generalizations about the church is just subordinated to the state hardly tells the whole story. And so many kind of cases like this where understanding Russia and the history of Russian Orthodoxy and its contemporary manifestations is much more nuanced than one would pick up from these kind of general statements.
I would only add that what we were trying to do is a kind of a very concise and balanced, I hope it's balanced, knowledge on the role of Christianity, the role Christianity played in Russian history and play and continues to play now. So that's was the idea, to make it really concise and really balanced in terms of giving some kind of general idea about both the teaching practices, the specifics, and political involvement and historical narrative, they call it historical narrative, and adding it up with what's going on now, what are kind of contemporary arrangements of Orthodoxy. So I hope that we did this in a relatively small, well, can we call it small or not that much, but not definitely not the one that Scott made on the monasticism, which is much more detailed and documented. But this one, the idea was different. The idea was really to present it in a very concise way, but also to refer and to refer to all the research and the studies that have been done. And so we have this additional bibliography that we hope will help the readers to go further to develop their knowledge in different aspects of the book.
And do you envision this as a teaching resource?
Yeah, very much. I mean, I teach both classes here at Miami University to kind of Introduction to World Christianity and also Introduction to Russian Studies. And I had my students in mind as I was writing the book, right, of trying to explain things in a way that would be accessible for them. And I will certainly use it, especially in my Russian studies books, Russian studies classes. And the way the book is structured is that there's the first the chapters, for the most part, can be used separately. So the if you want to understand what is Orthodoxy in general and what is Russian Orthodoxy, you know, you can just read chapter one. If you're let's say teaching a history class and you either yourself or you want your students to understand kind of the scope of the history of the Russian Orthodox Church and Russian Christianity, that's chapter three and also chapter four. If you're interested like in modern Russian religious thought in the 19th and 20th centuries, that's chapter five. If you're interested in kind of politics and society since the collapse of the Soviet Union, that's chapter six. So each chapter can be, even though they build on each other, they can also be used separately for, let's say, people who are teaching either Russian politics or Russian culture or Russian history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this is certainly a resource that I wish I'd had when I taught a seminar, Introduction to Russian Orthodoxy, because the other books I found were either too specific or too academic or scholarly, or just kind of too expansive, right? So I think this is really the perfect kind of filling to that gap.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to New Books in Russian and Eurasian Studies. I've been speaking with Dr. Scott Kenworthy, Associate Professor in the Department of Comparative Religion at Miami University in Oxford, Ohio, and Dr. Alexander Aganjanian, Professor at the Center for the Study of Religion at Russian State University of Humanities in Moscow. And we've been discussing their 2021 book, Understanding World Christianity Russia, which is currently available from Fortress Press. Doctors Kenworthy and Agajanian, thank you again for joining me today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.